Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm joined by
Ben Hunter.
And we're sitting across from Michelle Lecretzer, who is a Miles Franklin winner and has blown me away with her new book, The Life to Come. I was reading it over the weekend, and it is extraordinary. Both Ben and I are in agreement with that.
The whole office is in agreement.
This is
a life changer.
You will make me cry. Really.
Good. Well, it's a podcast. You can cry as much as you want.
Okay. No one can see.
Because I understand what it's like, putting a book in and then going out to the world, and the booksellers sell it out there, and then other people have your book in
yes.
their hands, and they can interpret it any way they like.
Yes, and I mean it's the wonderful thing about literature that a book is a product of an individual mind, and each individual reader will read it differently and interpret it differently. But it's also just very scary at this moment of publication, because you hope that it will resonate with readers, but you never know, because it's something that comes from one person. It might not find a wider audience. So it's very lovely that you did both enjoy it.
Well, something that was really clear was how many different books we were reading, because Robert, who works with us, was saying one thing, and then we ran into Morgan, a bookseller, who gave us another version of it.
Yes.
And then I read Ben's review and got another version of it, and then I read it myself and I thought, I have a different book.
Yes.
It's quite interesting how this one book is touching us in different ways and exciting our minds in different ways. And one thing that's kind of there for all of us is how to describe it in that elevator pitch.
Well, please tell me, because I don't know, really. I mean, do you think that one of the reasons you're having those different responses is because it is in five different sections, each of which is a self-contained world, although it also links to each of the others? Is that part of the reason that it's presenting different situations, and maybe one person is focusing on one and another on another?
Well, there seems to be... I've got a mirror ball in my mind where there's when you look in it, you get all these different reflections, and so depending on exactly when. So if I was to read it again, I probably would have a different reflections,
yes.
different points would come out to me. I mean, there are certain times when I'm reading it and I'm getting the place. The place seems
yes.
to be the bit that's leading me through,
yes.
mm.
And then next you'll just say something which is just so true about this modern moment right now. That takes my breath away, where I just think, I've been thinking this somewhere deep within me, but I've not been able to even express it, or I didn't even know I had it, and there it is, boom.
Well, that's the perfect moment as a writer, you hope for that. And thank you for the mirror ball metaphor, I'm going to steal that. You'll be hearing it in every single interview I do from now on.
I think perhaps because this novel encouraged us to, as a reader and as someone who's engaging with the subject, it encourages you to reevaluate the way you live and the place, for us at Sydney, the place that you live in. And from that, I think you're going to get all kinds of different reactions. You might get some really negative, some people might arc up about it, but I just thought it was, yeah, it, like I said, it's like John was saying, it completely flabbergasts the reader and just leaves you dumbfounded.
But one thing I don't want to get across here for the casual reader, this is not a difficult book to read. It's not. It draws you through. Like it's got a. If there are people out there who won't read a book that doesn't have some kind of pull through. This book has all that, as well as all the things we're talking about. Like it's a very.
Oh, thank you.
It's a very accessible book.
Thank you, because I was a bit worried about that because, as you know, there is one character who appears in every section, but. She is not the focus of every section. In fact, in some sections, she's quite a minor character.
Mm.
And I was a little bit worried that people require a character to follow through. And what I was trying to do by showing her in those different situations was how we only ever get really partial glimpses of people. You know, we see people in different contexts and we read them differently.
There's a lot of that going on, and that for me is one of the reasons why we where you get so many different ideas flowing, because you're already playing with that within the story.
Yes. I'm so glad that worked for you, because it was a little bit of, it felt a little bit risky as a thing to do as a writer. And I guess because my novels have always been fairly character driven, to not have that single focal point felt unnerving, but yet it was what I wanted to do, and you have to try different
things. Well, I got the same feeling that I have when I'm reading a collection of short stories. If I'm being dazzled by the writer and that break comes and I have to then start again with a new story,
yeah.
if I'm with the writer and I'm
yeah.
I make the leap without a worry in the world. I just jump across that little that little break and go straight into another one. This is what I did with this book. I didn't have any of that feeling where I have to start a whole new story.
Yeah, so thank you. I'm so glad. I mean, I did try to have each section to be compelling in itself, so that, each one would have its own narrative tension and its own narrative satisfactions.
Yeah.
And part of that was just trying to make the world of each of those sections as vivid and precise as possible.
Which is difficult when you admit that the way in which you're doing it is you're saying, like, you have one character who has lived in Sydney and knows all the byways and highways, and there's others who come in. Plus, we're meeting people who are young at one point and then older at another point. So their Sydney changes just because of their age range.
Yeah.
Kinds of things. So you're actually constantly turning these points of views around, and these experiences of the one place continually.
Yes. Well, I like that in my own reading. So one of the writers I've admired for a long time now is Alice Munro. And, I mean, she's usually talked about and admired for the way she depicts the lives, the interior lives of women. And certainly that's, one of the sort of huge things that she does excellently. But I've always been interested in what Munro does with time and with character. And so she, quite often, you'll get something like this. You have a story that begins with a woman who is in her 60s. And then it stops, and then you get the woman when she was 12. And then that stops, and then you get the woman when she was a young wife of, 28 or something. And maybe in the section when she's 28, it's actually not told through her eyes, but it'd be told through the eyes of the guy who runs the furniture store where she goes to buy, stuff for her new house or something. And I really like the way that that does. So first of all, you're seeing a character move through time. And secondly, you get from writing that character's mind and seeing the world through their eyes, suddenly there's a little swivel and you see her through, a completely different focus.
But the thing that which is there is that the character, something about the character of that individual is seen, but stripped of the 60 years, if it's the...
Yes, yes.
For me, the one book that really stood out for me with that was Earthly Powers by Anthony Burgess. He starts with a very decadent 60 or 70-year-old kind of Somerset Maugham, done everything, did everybody kind of man, and then it flashes back to 18 and starts the whole, how did he get to be that spot? And it just, all the person is the same.
Yes.
It just, all the stuff, all the experience drops from it in a turn of a page.
Yes.
And this is the kind of thing that I recognise the character immediately in your book, but I know that there's been a shift because of their experience of something.
Yes.
And so you're going, but oh no, you don't now.
That's right.
And so your reaction is going to be completely different in this in this circumstance, because you haven't been through this, and we know you're going through that, but we're coming back to... There's that wonderful sense throughout this.
Oh, thank you. Well, I find that very moving when I read. I mean, that sort of Burgess thing of, seeing someone at the height of their powers, or, with this sort of accretion of time and experience, and then seeing them young and vulnerable.
Yeah, and innocent.
And then what the world has done to them.
Exactly.
And, yeah, So, I mean, if I've been able to recreate that even in a small way, I'm really...
Well, you won the Miles Franklin for How to Travel, and the rules and regulations of the Miles, it kind of sort of talks about you know, trying to find the real Australia or the Australia for that moment or that kind of thing. To me, this book captures us in all our vanities and all our hypocrisies and our pointlessness. Some of our beauty.
Our obsession with food.
Obsession with food. It's a snapshot of now. I mean, I've been reading a lot of books that, you know, that... I mean, I have to read a lot. Out of Travel, the Questions of Travel. And I'm, you know, I'm amazed at just how many little things that you pick up, you've picked up and you've put into this book, and it don't seem like they're out of place, but they are little observations about things that are going, in essence, wrong with us in this moment in time, and that we need someone like you to actually point out, and so we sort of adjust, or a writer, an artist, to be able to see it and to pull it out and go, you know, you can talk your big ideas, but I think you went wrong here. And this belief that you have here this idea is where it's all gone wrong. And I just tease it out and put it in this little story here, and you can see it working poorly for the character.
Yeah.
Then maybe you can adjust yourself. And I think this is one of those books which is actually going to adjust people, because there are people out there telling you and shouting at you to do this and change the other. But literature is fantastic for showing you and giving you that virtual experience of it without any harm on yourself,
yeah.
harm on the character. but you go through it and you feel the shame, or you feel the that little burning of the cheeks that sort of redden when you realise you've done that and you've been that person, and this is the reaction.
I have always been that person, so I promise you there's nothing I'm saying in here which is not directed at myself.
Well, it's that honesty which needs to be part of it. Yeah. I mean, you can't really do that kind of a writer and not use yourself as kind of as part of the experiment.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you got that. I would hate people to think that I was just, passing judgment on Australia without feeling implicated in it.
No, there's an inclusive feeling about this whole thing. It's not, because when you switch to Paris, because it does go to Paris.
Yeah.
When you switch to Paris, we get a sense of that distance between us and Australia, and just like many people's experience when they go travelling or they're living in another city, they sort of find other Australians or some connection to their homeland, and then they have a sort of a distant discussion about it, and they have a bit of distance to be able to make an objective, evaluation of it. And I think that works really well in this, because you do fling us over to Paris out of our comfort zone of Sydney.
Yes.
And we then look back and we see that, and that wonderful character looking back, especially with her family coming over and joining her, and how distant she feels from all the commercialism, all the stuff that they have.
When did they start eating pomegranates in Perth? For someone who's been out of the country a long time, it's also a bit how, out of touch. When you've left a place, in your mind, it stays the way it was when you left it, and doesn't change. I mean, I have to correct myself and pull myself up when I think about Sri Lanka, that it's not the same country I left. It's gone on and changed heaps.
Yeah.
But there's always that danger for the migrant or the expatriate that the place you've come from is stuck in aspic, and it's never moved on from when you left.
I remember a girlfriend of mine came out from Italy, and she came out to and met Italians here and just went, what is going on with you people?
Yes, totally.
What is this, the 1950s?
totally. So I sort of wanted both sides of that. So yes, so Celeste in Paris, who's sort of French-Australian, and I think is rightly dismayed by the kind of overwhelming wealth that is taken for granted by her family back in Australia, that this is just what they now measure everyone by, and she's seen as a bit of a failure because she doesn't have that material success.
I hated them for that little doubt that went into her head.
Yes.
I absolutely hated them for it.
Yes, yes. And at the same time, she just hasn't sort of, you know, in her mind, it's still a very backward place. And she hasn't realised, you know, how Australia has kept pace with the rest of the world. And,
which you then show by the mild racism that happens within the French.
Yes, yes.
And you think, my God, we're so beyond that.
Yes, you know, yes. I mean, the anti-Semitism, for instance, which is quite, you know, which you hear in casual conversation.
Yeah.
I certainly don't hear it around me. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, but I think people watch themselves a bit more, at least, as far as anti-Semitism is concerned. Although, you know, maybe some of my Jewish friends would feel differently.
Well, in some ways, it's a very pro-Sydney, pro-Australia kind of book, but it's not without its... But don't forget.
Because
it's. I mean, there are so many wonderful scenes where you think where anyone who lives in Sydney will go, I really should get out more. I really should. I really should take time and get out of my car and walk and see some of this stuff that Michelle has reminded me about, because it's kind of mortifying that I haven't been over that side of Sydney, or I haven't done this, and I haven't, you know, for 10 years has gone by, and I haven't even gone into those areas.
I mean, for me, this book exposes this idea I had as a young man kind of coming down here and living here, is that Sydney is just this this mystical place that just exists at the centre of the universe. And we look to Europe, and we look to the States, and we look to the Near East as kind of, you know, the stars, the heavens. And we have these aspirational thoughts, and we think about the magic of those places and how they came about, and we think about their histories, but our own sort of world just exists for us. But to see, to sort of sit in the shoes of the character who's looking up at those sandstone, that sandstone wall going down the hill in Annandale, towards the water, and just seeing the awe of the thing is just, it just completely misplaces the mind.
Thank you. Well, I guess it's because I'm still a relative newcomer to Sydney, so I don't take it for granted yet, and it fills me with awe, and I notice those things because they're very different from... Sydney is geographically very
bizarre.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Enormous waterland, and then has a sprawling western.
And those suburbs and
yes,
yes, yes, and the, you know, the myriad lives that they contain.
Yes, these little microcosms of pockets of humanity that are all rivaling one another.
Yeah,
but in a very in a very less historical and deep-seated way, as you would get in an old town like Paris or London.
Yes, yes.
Although you remind us in Paris that it stops.
Yeah.
And that the new comes in.
The new comes in.
Yeah, there's a. You have to get beyond this particular station, and then you see the real Paris, or the, depending on who point of view.
Yeah.
But something we haven't discussed is art and artistic aspiration and writing and. And the development of writers, because the central to this book is this character who sort of picks up on all these different things, and there is that relationship between writers and a relationship between those who are on the outside and the devastating effect they can have with their casualness around someone's vocation.
Yeah.
There's all these different things. How much you hit the mark, like bang, bang, bang. Is that largely because of the circles you're in, or is it again lined up with more about your experience of people rather than these types of writers?
Oh, I think people in general, and of course some observations that are particular to writers, but I suspect would apply to artists of any kind. I mean, I'm writing about novelists there, but. I think would apply also to filmmakers or visual artists or perhaps to musicians. I guess that partly there's something, some fear I needed to address about my own writing, that what it meant to have had this amazing, just random luck of the Miles Franklin and being seen as a successful writer, and what that means. Mm. And so, you know, Pippa represents all that I fear might come true of me, really.
Yeah.
And I want to keep that at a distance. I really do.
So
yeah. I feel very grateful for it. Don't get me wrong.
But as an artist, when you look back on your past books, do you, like, there's always going to be, I could have written that better, I could have written that better. But are you pleased, like, that you're able to complete these things and have these things which are...
I mean, of course. I mean, I have been hugely lucky. My books have been published. I mean, from my first book, you know, it was picked up quickly and published. And I think of so many people who just have, who struggle to get to even that stage of getting one book published. And they are good writers, but... You know, it's hard. Mm. So yeah, I think I have been incredibly, incredibly fortunate in my career.
And
not that I feel pleased about the books themselves. I mean, I never reread them, of course, John. You know that. Yeah. I mean, you know, it would be
ghastly.
You know? Yeah. But no, I feel I have. Had incredible good luck in Australia as far as career goes.
So with we're on the, you know, the bold and brash side of book selling. We've got websites, we've got YouTube videos, we've got all these different things going on to sell books, and we sell a lot of books, and we often sell the most popular books in huge numbers, and we're part of that machine.
Yes,
which is there. You know,
thank goodness for
yeah,
you. Yes.
The publishing world is, you know, ever hungry for the next Dan Brown, and ever hungry for what are the kids going to be wanting next? Is it Harry Potter? Is it Twilight? Is it what? In that environment, and there's been a lot of articles over the last... I don't think it's ever stopped. I think if you go back to Gissing, you've got the same problem.
Yeah.
But in the last little while, there's been a lot of articles about how authors can exist in this environment with the advances going down and the revenue coming through is less. Is it enough to be doing good work? This is the question, because this is what's in my brain at the moment.
Yeah.
Is does, I know it's extraordinarily difficult working other jobs and doing other things to keep you alive, but is there enough satisfaction in getting it to the best you can do at that particular time to sort of drive you to the next attempt?
Oh, I think there's incredible satisfaction in that. I think if I feel I have written one good sentence, that's really, really satisfying and a reward in itself. And basically, I think writers who are doing literary fiction have to look to the writing for our rewards, because everything else is uncertain. You know, I mean, I've had very good support from booksellers and from my publishers, but in the end, you know, whether a book is a success or a failure out there in the marketplace, who can tell?
Who do you turn to? So if you're, there are some people who are lucky to have partners who are their best critics and their judges, and if they get the nod from the partner, they go, well, I'm satisfied, that's it. Everyone else can work it out for themselves.
Yes.
And some people have a sort of a group of writer friends who they trust and share it out with and sort of go, well, if I get a good response from these guys, then I'm satisfied, and I'll let the readers do what they like and the booksellers do what they like. Is it like that? Do you have a kind of a little ever larger circle of people that do?
Yeah, I'd say so. So I guess the first person is my partner, who reads it. He's the first reader of the whole thing, but also sometimes, fairly regularly over the course of writing, which might take, you know, 3 years or whatever, I might ask him to read a section, you know, it might be a few pages or a few hundred words, and say, what do you think? And really, at that point, his function is to say, it's terrific, keep going. I don't want actually to hear anything else, because it's just writing is it's a matter of holding your nerve, and if you're writing novels, you have to hold your nerve over, you know, well, probably at least a couple of years for most people.
Yeah.
So that is what I want from him at that stage. When he reads the whole thing, then I want him to tell me this bit is, you know, unclear, this bit is not working.
Are you in a
gentle, loving way?
Yeah.
Of
so you're in your armor then. You're ready. You're prepared. Like, is that the?
Yeah.
Is that the moment when you sort of go,
at that stage,
I have.
You know, I've got to the end of it. I think the difficult thing for writers is always to get to the end of that first draft.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've got that out there, then you can fix stuff.
Yeah.
But you have to have it there in order to fix it. So I think that's always the biggest hurdle, and that's why, you know, to get to the end of that draft, you need someone saying, yes, keep going. And then I see stuff. I leave, you know, time between my drafts, like between first and second, I would leave usually 6 weeks at
really
least.
That long? Wow.
Yeah, because time is the best editor of all.
Mm.
You know,
I give Ben 24 hours.
And sometimes that's not enough.
Well, six weeks is good. I mean, I remember reading, I can't remember who it was now, but one of the, I think it was one of the Paris Review people saying that long, and I was thinking, why could I leave it that long? Could I make it through 6 weeks not going near it? But you do.
I do. And if I, you know, in the meantime, of course, I'll be thinking of things that I'll just jot down on a notepad, you know, things I want to change or, you know, want to look at again or something. Anyway, I usually do about three to four drafts, and then I send it to my agent. And she's the first sounding board, and I guess if she thought it were not... I mean, I kind of trust her to tell me this is ready to go or it's not ready to go.
Yeah.
And she will usually give me some feedback, and I say to her, look, you know, let's have another pass at it and work on it some more. So I guess by the time it then gets sent to a publisher, it's had at least four drafts. So then publisher reads it. I still want to keep it fairly small at this stage, because I think if you give it to, especially if it's in its early stages, and you give it to 10 different people, you get 10 different opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want it to be a small group of people whom I trust and who I think get my work, and they might not think it's, you know, the most brilliant in the world, but they know what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And so I get that feedback from them. And then, you know, this time I also gave it to some trusted writer friends after my publisher had read it and said, you know, they were going ahead with it. So Fiona McFarlane, wonderful Sydney writer, and Mireille Juchot, also from here, who are both friends of mine and who very generously and kindly said they would read it and give me feedback.
Reading it with so many different things going on there, you really do need someone who really gets what you're attempting to do. I mean, you can't have some commercial fiction writer go, oh, what's going on here?
you really have to have someone
who's in your brain, right, who gets it.
Yeah.
To say, no, that's done on for a reason, and it ties in, you'll find out. Just keep going.
Yeah. And Ivor Indyk, who you'd know from being the publisher of Giramondo, also very kindly offered to read it for me, so I gave it to him as well. So, you know, there were... So as well as the sort of people in my publisher's circles, and that includes, you know, the US and the UK and here, there were also these other people who came in and, you know, just read it out of goodness and generosity, really. So I'm really grateful to them.
We're going to have to wrap it up, although we could probably keep asking you questions for ages. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us and being so open about the process as well, and because that's so interesting to us too.
Thank you. You know, do you not feel these things with your books that you?
I think I'm more of a wuss than you are. I think you've sort of. You've got that sort of strength around what you're trying to do. Until very recently, my one I would have, you know, handed out to everyone. And go, tell me it's good. And then get, as you said, all these terrible opinions.
But that's much braver, I think. I'm the worst. Like I will. I'm basically only giving it to people.
But you're holding to your idea and not allowing everyone else to jump in and to to.
And when you see a book outside of its finished form, outside of the bound product,
yeah,
it's even for someone who's been around writing and the publishing world, it's suddenly in a completely different scenario, and it's hard to measure what do I call finished product and what do I say this feels untethered, because normally you become very used to the comfort of a bound finished book.
Yeah. Everything in here is on purpose.
Yes. So I'm very grateful to the people who read it before it's a book, as it were, and give me feedback at that point.
We're grateful to them too, because we're blessed with such a fantastic
book. Absolutely. We can't say it enough. This is the must-read book for this summer. If you're thinking about getting one of the... we're very lucky this summer to have so many great Australian writers publishing, but at the moment for us this is put it on top of your pile.
Oh, thank you. That's really, really kind of you. I am going to cry.
Thank you, Michelle, for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you can get hold of all of Michelle's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.